talk of Manderley at last. But something held him back. Some phobia that struggled to the surface of his mind and won supremacy, for he blew out his match and his flash of confidence at the same time. "So the friend of the bosom has a holiday," he said on a level plane again, an easy camaraderie between us. "What does she propose to do with it?" I thought of the cobbled square in Monaco and the house with the narrow window. I could be off there by 3 o'clock with my sketchbook and pencil, and I told him as much, a little shyly, perhaps, like all untalented persons with a pet hobby. "I'll drive you there in the car," he said, and would not listen to protests. I remembered Mrs. Van Hopper's warning of the night before about putting myself forward, and was embarrassed that he might think my talk of Monaco was a subterfuge to win a lift. It was so blatantly the type of thing that she would do herself, and I did not want him to bracket us together. I had already risen in importance from my lunch with him, for as we got up from the table, the little maître d'hôtel rushed forward to pull away my chair. He bowed and smiled, a total change from his usual attitude of indifference, picked up my handkerchief that had fallen on the floor, and hoped Mademoiselle had enjoyed her lunch. Even the page-boy by the swing doors glanced at me with respect. My companion accepted it as natural, of course. He knew nothing of the ill-carved ham of yesterday. I found the change depressing. It made me despise myself. I remembered my father and his scorn of superficial snobbery. "What are you thinking about?" We were walking along the corridor to the lounge, and looking up I saw his eyes fixed on me in curiosity. "Has something annoyed you?" he said. The attentions of the maître d'hôtel had opened up a train of thought, and as we drank coffee I told him about Blaise, the dressmaker. She had been so pleased when Mrs. Van Hopper had bought 3 frocks, and I, taking her to the lift afterwards, had pictured her working upon them in her own small salon, behind the stuffy little shop, with a consumptive sun wasting upon her sofa. I could see her with tired eyes threading needles, and the floor covered with snippets of material. "Well," he said, smiling, "wasn't your picture true?" "I don't know," I said. "I never found out." And I told him how I had rung the bell for the lift, and as I had done so, she had fumbled in her bag and gave me a note for 100 francs. "Here," she had whispered, her tone intimate and unpleasant, "I want you to accept this small commission in return for bringing your patron to my shop." When I had refused, scarlet with embarrassment, she had shrugged her shoulders disagreeably. "Just as you like," she had said, "but I assure you it's quite usual. Perhaps you would rather have a frock. Come along to the shop sometime without madame and I will fix you up without charging you a sou." Somehow, I don't know why, I had been aware of that sick, unhealthy feeling I had experienced as a child when turning the pages of a forbidden book. The vision of the consumptive sun faded, and in its stead arose the picture of myself had I been different, pocketing that greasy note with an understanding smile, and perhaps slipping round to Blaise's shop on this, my free afternoon, and coming away with a frock I had not paid for. I expected him to laugh. It was a stupid story. I don't know why I told him. But he looked at me thoughtfully as he stirred his coffee. "I think you've made a big mistake," he said after a moment. "In refusing that 100 francs, I asked, revolted. "No, good heavens, what do you take me for? I think you've made a mistake in coming here and joining forces with Mrs. Van Hopper. You're not made for that sort of job. You're too young, for one thing, and too soft. Blaise and her commission, that's nothing. The first of many similar incidents from other Blazes. You will either have to give in and become a sort of Blaise yourself, or stay as you are and be broken. Who suggested you took on this thing in the first place?" It seemed natural for him to question me, nor did I mind. It was as though we had known one another for a long time, and had met again after a lapse of years. "Have you ever thought about the future?" he asked me, "and what this sort of thing will lead to? Supposing Mrs. Van Hopper gets tired of her friend of the bosom, what then?" I smiled and told him that I did not mind very much. There would be other Mrs. Van Hoppers, and I was young and confident and strong. But even as he spoke, I remembered those advertisements seen often in good-class magazines where a friendly society demands succor for young women in reduced circumstances. I thought of the type of boarding house that answers the advertisement and gives temporary shelter, and then I saw myself, Eustace, sketchbook in hand, without qualifications of any kind, stammering replies to stern employment agents. Perhaps I should have accepted Blaze's 10%. "How old are you?" he said, and when I told him he laughed and got up from his chair. "I know that age. It's a particularly obstinate one, and 1,000 bogies won't make you fear the future. A pity we can't change over. Go upstairs and put your hat on, and I'll have the car brought round." As he watched me into the lift, I thought of yesterday, Mrs. Van Hopper's chattering tongue and his cold courtesy. I had ill-judged him. He was neither hard nor sardonic. He was already my friend of many years, the brother I had never possessed. Mine was a happy mood that afternoon, and I remember it well. I can see the rippled sky, fluffy with cloud, and the white, whipped sea. I can feel again the wind on my face, and hear my laugh and his that echoed it. It was not the Monte Carlo I had known, or perhaps the truth was that it pleased me better. There was a glamour about it that had not been before. I must have looked upon it before with dull eyes. The harbour was a dancing thing with fluttering paper boats, and the sailors on the quay were jovial, smiling fellows, merry as the wind. We passed the yacht, beloved of Mrs. Van Hopper because of its ducal owner, and snapped our fingers at the glistening brass, and looked at one another and laughed again. I can remember, as though I wore it still, my comfortable, ill-fitting flannel suit, and how the skirt was lighter than the coat, through harder wear. My shabby hat too broad about the brim, and my low-heeled shoes fastened with a single strap. A pair of gauntlet gloves clutched in a grubby hand. I had never looked more youthful. I had never felt so old. Mrs. Van Hopper and her influenza did not exist for me. The bridge and the cocktail parties were forgotten, and with them my own humble status. I was a person of importance. I was grown up at last. That girl, who, tortured by shyness, would stand outside the sitting-room door, twisting a handkerchief in her hands, while from within came that babble of confused chatter, so unnerving to the intruder. She had gone with the wind that afternoon. She was a poor creature, and I thought of her with scorn, if I considered her at all. The wind was too high for sketching. It tore in cheerful gusts around the corner of my cobbled square, and back to the car we went and drove I know not where. The long road climbed the hills, and the car climbed with it, and we circled in the heights like a bird in the air. How different his car to Mrs. Van Hopper's hireling for the season, a square old-fashioned Daimler that took us to Monton on placid afternoons, when I, sitting on the little seat with my back to the driver, must crane my neck to see the view. This car had the wings of Mercury, I thought, for higher yet we climbed, and dangerously fast, and the danger pleased me because it was new to me, because I was young. I remember laughing aloud, and the laugh being carried by the wind away from me, and looking at him, I realized he laughed no longer. He was once more silent and detached, the man of yesterday wrapped in his secret self. I realized, too, that the car could climb no more. We had reached the summit, and below us stretched the way that we had come, precipitous and hollow. He stopped the car, and I could see that the edge of the road bordered a vertical slope that crumbled into vacancy, a fall of perhaps 2,000 feet. We got out of the car and looked beneath us. This sobered me at last. I knew that but half the car's length had lain between us and the fall. The sea, like a crinkled chart, spread to the horizon and lapped the sharp outline of the coast, while the houses were white shells in a rounded grotto, pricked here and there by a great orange sun. We knew another sunlight on our hill, and the silence made it harder, more austere. A change had come upon our afternoon. It was not the thing of gossamer it had been. The wind dropped, and it suddenly grew cold. When I spoke, my voice was far too casual, the silly, nervous voice of someone ill at ease. "Do you know this place?" I said. "Have you been here before?" He looked down at me without recognition, and I realized with a little stab of anxiety that he must have forgotten all about me, perhaps for some considerable time, and that he himself was so lost in the labyrinth of his own unquiet thoughts that I did not exist. He had the face of one who walks in his sleep, and for a wild moment the idea came to me that perhaps he was not normal, not altogether sane. There were people who had trances. I had surely heard of them, and they followed strange laws of which we could know nothing. They obeyed the tangled orders of their own subconscious minds. Perhaps he was one of them, and here we were, within 6 feet of death. "It's getting late. Shall we go home?" I said, and my careless tone, my little ineffectual smile, would scarcely have deceived a child. I had misjudged him, of course. There was nothing wrong, after all. For as soon as I spoke this second time, he came clear of his dream and began to apologize. I had gone white, I suppose, and he had noticed it. "That was an unforgivable thing for me to do," he said. And taking my arm, he pushed me back towards the car, and we climbed in again, and he slammed the door. "Don't be frightened. The turn is far easier than it looks," he said. And while I, sick and giddy, clung to the seat with both hands, he manoeuvred the car gently, very gently, until it faced the sloping road once more. "Then you have been here before," I said to him, my sense of strain departing, as the car crept away down the twisting narrow road.
"Yes," he said, and then after pausing a moment, "but not for many years. I wanted to see if it had changed."
"And has it?" I asked him.
"No," he said. "No, it has not changed."
I wondered what had driven him to this retreat into the past, with me an unconscious witness of his mood. What gulf of years stretched between him and that other time? What deed of thought and action, what difference in temperament? I did not want to know. I wished I had not come. Down the twisting road we went without a check, without a word. A great ridge of clouds stretched above the setting sun, and the air was cold and clean. Suddenly he began to talk about Manderley. He said nothing of his life there, no word about himself, but he told me how the sun set there on a spring afternoon, leaving a glow upon the headland. The sea would look like slate, cold still from the long winter, and from the terrace you could hear the ripple of the coming tide washing in the little bay. The daffodils were in bloom, stirring in the evening breeze, golden heads cupped upon lean stalks. And however many you might pick, there would be no thinning of the ranks. They were massed like an army, shoulder to shoulder. On a bank below the lawns, crocuses were planted, golden, pink, and mauve. But by this time they would be past their best, dropping and fading like pallid snowdrops. The primrose was more vulgar, a homely, pleasant creature who appeared in every cranny like a weed. Too early yet for bluebells, their heads were still hidden beneath last year's leaves, but when they came, dwarfing the more humble violet, they choked the very bracken in the woods, and with their colour made a challenge to the sky. He never would have them in the house, he said. Thrust into vases, they became dank and listless, and to see them at their best you must walk in the woods in the morning about 12 o'clock when the sun was overhead. They had a smoky, rather bitter smell, as though a wild sap ran in their stalks, pungent and juicy. People who plucked bluebells from the woods were vandals. He had forbidden it at Manderley. Sometimes, driving in the country, he had seen bicyclists with huge bunches strapped before them on the handles, the bloom already fading from the dying heads, the ravaged stalks straggling naked and unclean. The primrose did not mind it quite so much. Although a creature of the wilds, it had a leaning towards civilization, and preened and smiled in a jam jar in some cottage window without resentment, living quite a week if given water. No wild flowers came in the house at Manderley. He had special cultivated flowers grown for the house alone in the walled garden. A rose was one of the few flowers, he said, that looked better picked than growing. A bowl of roses in a drawing-room had a depth of colour and scent they had not possessed in the open. There was something rather blousy about roses in full bloom, something shallow and raucous like women with untidy hair. In the house they became mysterious and subtle. He had roses in the house at Manderley for 8 months in the year.
Did I like Syringa? He asked me. There was a tree on the edge of the lawn he could smell from his bedroom window. His sister, who was a hard, rather practical person, used to complain that there were too many scents at Manderley. They made her drunk. Perhaps she was right. He did not care. It was the only form of intoxication that appealed to him. His earliest recollection was of great branches of lilac standing in white jars, and they filled the house with a wistful, poignant smell. The little pathway down the valley to the bay had clumps of azalea and rhododendron planted to the left of it, and if you wandered down it on a May evening after dinner, it was just as though the shrubs had sweated in the air. You could stoop down and pick a fallen petal, crush it between your fingers, and you had there, in the hollow of your hand, the essence of a thousand scents, unbearable and sweet, all from a curled and crumpled petal. And you came out of the valley, heady and rather dazed, to the hard white shingle of the beach and the still water. A curious, perhaps too sudden contrast. As he spoke, the car became one of many once again. Dusk had fallen without my noticing it, and we were in the midst of light and sound in the streets of Monte Carlo. The clatter dragged on my nerves, and the lights were far too brilliant, far too yellow. It was a swift, unwelcome anticlimax. Soon we would come to the hotel, and I felt for my gloves in the pocket of the car. I found them, and my fingers closed upon a book as well, whose slim covers told of poetry. I peered to read the title as the car slowed down before the door of the hotel. "You can take it and read it if you like," he said, his voice casual and indifferent now that the drive was over, and we were back again, and Manderley was many hundreds of miles distant. I was glad, and held it tightly with my gloves. I felt I wanted some possession of his, now that the day was finished.
"Hop out," he said. "I must go and put the car away. I shan't see you in the restaurant this evening as I'm dining out, but thank you for today."
I went up the hotel steps alone, with all the despondency of a child whose treat is over. My afternoon had spoilt me for the hours that still remained, and I thought how long they would seem until my bedtime. How empty, too, my supper all alone. Somehow I could not face the bright inquiries of the nurse upstairs or the possibilities of Mrs. Van Hopper's husky interrogation, so I sat down in the corner of the lounge behind a pillar and ordered tea. The waiter appeared, bored. Seeing me alone, there was no need for him to press, and anyway it was that dragging time of day, a few minutes after 5:30, when the normal tea is finished and the hour for drinks remote. Rather forlorn, more than a little dissatisfied, I leant back in my chair and took up the book of poems. The volume was well worn, well thumbed, falling open automatically at what must be a much frequented page. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind, and in the midst of tears I hid from him, and under running laughter. Up vistaed slopes I sped and shot, precipitated adown titanic glooms of chasmed fears, from those strong feet that followed, followed after. I felt rather like someone peering through the keyhole of a locked door. And a little furtively I laid the book aside. What hound of heaven had driven him to the high hills this afternoon? I thought of his car with half a length between it and the drop of 2,000 feet, and the blank expression on his face. What footsteps echoed in his mind? What whispers? And what memories? And why, of all poems, must he keep this one in the pocket of his car? I wished he were less remote, and I anything but the creature that I was in my shabby coat and skirt, my broad-brimmed schoolgirl hat. The sulky waiter brought my tea, and while I ate bread and butter, dull as sawdust, I thought of the pathway through the valley he had described to me this afternoon, the smell of the azaleas, and the white shingle of the bay. If he loved it all so much, why did he seek the superficial froth of Monte Carlo? He had told Mrs. Van Hopper he had made no plans, he came away in rather a hurry, and I pictured him running down that pathway in the valley with his own hound of heaven at his heels. I picked up the book again, and this time it opened at the title page, and I read the dedication. Max from Rebecca, 17th of May. Written in a curious slanting hand. A little blob of ink marred the white page opposite, as though the writer, in impatience, had shaken her pen to make the ink flow freely. And then, as it bubbled through the nib, it came a little thick, so that the name, Rebecca, stood out black and strong, the tall and sloping R dwarfing the other letters. I shut the book with a snap and put it away under my gloves. And stretching to a nearby chair, I took up an old copy of L'Illustration and turned the pages. There were some fine photographs of the Château of the Loire and an article as well. I read it carefully, referring to the photographs. But when I finished, I knew I had not understood a word. It was not Blois, with its thin turrets and its spires that stared up at me from the printed page. It was the face of Mrs. Van Hopper in the restaurant the day before, her small pig's eyes darting to the neighbouring table, her fork heaped high with ravioli, pausing in mid-air. "An appalling tragedy," she was saying. "The papers were full of it, of course. They say he never talks about it, never mentions her name. She was drowned, you know, in the bay, near Manderley." Chapter 5. I am glad it cannot happen twice, the fever of first love. For it is a fever, and a burden too, whatever the poets may say. They are not brave, the days when we are 21. They are full of little cowardices, little fears without foundation, and one is so easily bruised, so swiftly wounded, one falls to the first barbed word. Today, wrapped in the complacent armour of approaching middle age, the infinitesimal pricks of day by day brush one lightly and are soon forgotten. But then, how a careless word would linger, becoming a fiery stigma, and how a look, a glance over a shoulder, branded themselves as things eternal. A denial heralded the thrice crowing of a cock, and an insincerity was like the kiss of Judas. The adult mind can lie with untroubled conscience and a gay composure, but in those days even a small deception scoured the tongue, lashing one against the stake itself. "What have you been doing this morning?" I can hear her now, propped against her pillows with all the small irritability of the patient who is not really ill, who has lain in bed too long, and I, reaching to the bedside drawer for the pack of cards, would feel the guilty flush form patches on my neck. "I've been playing tennis with a professional," I told her, the false words bringing me to panic even as I spoke. For what if the professional himself should come up to the suite then, that very afternoon, and bursting in upon her complain that I had missed my lesson now for many days? "The trouble is, with me laid up like this, you haven't got enough to do," she said, mashing her cigarette in a jar of cleansing cream, and taking the cards in her hand, she mixed them in the deft, irritating shuffle of the inveterate player, shaking them in threes, snapping the backs. "I don't know what you find to do with yourself all day," she went on. "You never have any sketches to show me. And when I do ask you to do some shopping for me, you forget to buy my Taxol. All I can say is that I hope your tennis will improve. It will be useful to you later on. A poor player is a great bore. Do you still serve underhand?" She flipped the Queen of Spades into the pool, and the dark face stared up at me like Jezebel. "Yes," I said, stung by her question, thinking how just and appropriate her word. It described me well. I was underhand. I had not played tennis with a professional at all. I had not once played since she had lain in bed. And that was a little over a fortnight now. I wondered why it was I clung to this reserve, and why it was I did not tell her that every morning I drove with De Winter in his car and lunched with him, too, at his table in the restaurant. "You must come up to the net more. You will never play a good game until you do," she continued. And I agreed, flinching at my own hypocrisy, covering the queen with the weak-chinned knave of hearts. I have forgotten much of Monte Carlo, of those morning drives, of where we went, even our conversation. But I have not forgotten how my fingers trembled, cramming on my hat, and how I ran along the corridor and down the stairs, too impatient to wait for the slow whining of the lift, and so outside, brushing the swing doors before the commissionaire could help me. He would be there, in the driver's seat, reading a paper while he waited, and when he saw me he would smile and toss it behind him in the back seat and open the door, saying, "Well, how is the friend of the bosom this morning, and where does she want to go?" If he had driven round in circles, it would not have mattered to me, for I was in that first flushed stage when to climb into the seat beside him and lean forward to the windscreen hugging my knees was almost too much to bear. I was like a little scrubby schoolboy with a passion for a sixth-form prefect, and he kinder and far more inaccessible.
"There's a cold wind this morning. You'd better put on my coat."
I remember that, for I was young enough to win happiness in the wearing of his clothes, playing the schoolboy again who carries his hero's sweater and ties it about his throat, choking with pride. And this borrowing of his coat, wearing it around my shoulders for even a few minutes at a time, was a triumph in itself and made a glow about my morning. Not for me the languor and the subtlety I had read about in books, the challenge and the chase, the sword play, the swift glance, the stimulating smile. The art of provocation was unknown to me, and I would sit with his map upon my lap, the wind blowing my dull, lanky hair, happy in his silence, yet eager for his words. Whether he talked or not made little difference to my mood. My only enemy was the clock on the dashboard, whose hands would move relentlessly to 1 o'clock. We drove east, we drove west, amidst the myriad villages that cling like limpets to the Mediterranean shore. And today, I remember none of them. All I remember is the feel of the leather seats, the texture of the map upon my knee, its frayed edges, its worn seams, and how one day, looking at the clock, I thought to myself, "This moment now, at 11:20, this must never be lost." And I shut my eyes to make the experience more lasting. When I opened my eyes, we were by a bend in the road, and a peasant girl in a black shawl waved to us. I can see her now, her dusty skirt, her gleaming, friendly smile, and in a second we had passed the bend and could see her no more. Already she belonged to the past. She was only a memory. I wanted to go back again, to recapture the moment that had gone. And then it came to me that if we did, it would not be the same. Even the sun would be changed in the sky, casting another shadow, and the peasant girl would trudge past us along the road in a different way, not waving this time, perhaps not even seeing us. There was something chilling in the thought, something a little melancholy, and looking at the clock I saw that 5 more minutes had gone by. Soon we would have reached our time limit and must return to the hotel. If only there could be an invention, I said impulsively, that bottled up a memory like scent, and it never faded, and it never got stale, and then, when one wanted it, the bottle could be uncorked, and it would be like living the moment all over again. I looked up at him to see what he would say. He did not turn to me. He went on watching the road ahead.
"What particular moments in your young life do you wish uncorked?" he said.
I could not tell from his voice whether he was teasing me or not. "I'm not sure," I began, and then blundered on rather foolishly, not thinking of my words. "I'd like to keep this moment and never forget it."
"Is that meant to be a compliment to the day or to my driving?" he said. And as he laughed, like a mocking brother, I became silent, overwhelmed suddenly by the great gulf between us, and how his very kindness to me widened it. I knew then that I would never tell Mrs. Van Hopper about these morning expeditions, for her smile would hurt me as his laugh had done. She would not be angry, nor would she be shocked. She would raise her eyebrows very faintly, as though she did not altogether believe my story, and then with a tolerant shrug of the shoulder she would say, "My dear child, it's extremely sweet and kind of him to take you driving. The only thing is, are you sure it does not bore him dreadfully?" And then she would send me out to buy Taxol, patting me on the shoulder. What degradation lay in being young, I thought,
and fell to tearing my nails. "I wish," I said savagely, still mindful of his laugh and throwing discretion to the wind, "I wish I was a woman of about 36, dressed in black satin with a string of pearls."
"You would not be in this car with me if you were," he said. "And stop biting those nails, they're ugly enough already."
"You'll think me impertinent and rude, I dare say," I went on, "but I would like to know why you ask me to come out in the car day after day. You're being kind, that's obvious, but why do you choose me for your charity?" I sat up stiff and straight in my seat, and with all the poor pomposity of youth.
"I ask you," he said gravely, "because you are not dressed in black satin with a string of pearls, nor are you 36.
His face was without expression. I could not tell whether he laughed inwardly or not. "It's all very well," I said. "You know everything there is to know about me. There's not much, I admit, because I have not been alive for very long, and nothing much has happened to me, except people dying. But you, I know nothing more about you than I did the first day we met."
"And what did you know then?" he asked.
"Why, that you had lived at Manderley, and that you had lost your wife." There, I had said it at last. The word that had hovered on my tongue for days. "Your wife." It came out with ease, without reluctance, as though the mere mention of her must be the most casual thing in all the world. "Your wife." The word lingered in the air once I had uttered it, dancing before me, and because he received it silently, making no comment, the word magnified itself into something heinous and appalling, a forbidden word, unnatural to the tongue. And I could not call it back. It could never be unsaid. Once again I saw the inscription on the flyleaf of that book of poems, and the curious, slanting R. I felt sick at heart and cold. He would never forgive me, and this would be the end of our friendship. I remember staring straight in front of me at the windscreen, seeing nothing of the flying road, my ears still tingling with that spoken word. The silence became minutes, and the minutes became miles. "And everything is over now," I thought. "I shall never drive with him again. Tomorrow he will go away, and Mrs. Van Hopper will be up again. She and I will walk along the terrace as we did before. The porter will bring down his trunks. I shall catch a glimpse of them in the luggage lift, with new plastered labels, the bustle and finality of departure, the sound of the car changing gear as it turned the corner, and then even that sound merging into the common traffic and being lost, and so absorbed for ever. I was so deep in my picture. I even saw the porter pocketing his tip and going back through the swing door of the hotel, saying something over his shoulder to the commissionaire, that I did not notice the slowing down of the car, and it was only when we stopped, drawing up by the side of the road, that I brought myself back to the present once again. He sat motionless, looking without his hat and with his white scarf round his neck, more than ever like someone medieval who lived within a frame. He did not belong to the bright landscape. He should be standing on the steps of a gaunt cathedral, his cloak flung back, while a beggar at his feet scrambled for gold coins. The friend had gone, with his kindliness and his easy camaraderie, and the brother, too, who had mocked me for nibbling at my nails. This man was a stranger. I wondered why I was sitting beside him in the car. Then he turned to me and spoke.
"A little while ago you talked about an invention," he said. "Some scheme for capturing a memory. You would like, you told me, at a chosen moment, to live the past again. I'm afraid I think rather differently from you. All memories are bitter, and I prefer to ignore them. Something happened a year ago that altered my entire life, and I want to forget every phase in my existence up to that time. Those days are finished. They're blotted out. I must begin living all over again. The first day we met, your Mrs. Van Hopper asked me why I came to Monte Carlo. It put a stopper on those memories you would like to resurrect. It does not always work, of course. Sometimes the scent is too strong for the bottle and too strong for me. And then the devil in one, like a furtive peeping Tom, tries to draw the cork. I did that in the first drive we took together, when we climbed the hills and looked down over the precipice. I was there some years ago with my wife. You asked me if it was still the same, if it had changed at all. It was just the same, but I was thankful to realize, oddly impersonal. There was no suggestion of the other time. She and I had left no record. It may have been because you were with me. You have blotted out the past for me, you know, far more effectively than all the bright lights of Monte Carlo. But for you, I should have left long ago. Gone on to Italy and Greece, and further still, perhaps. You have spared me all those wanderings. Damn your puritanical little tight-lipped speech to me. Damn your idea of my kindness and my charity. I ask you to come with me because I want you and your company. And if you don't believe me, you can leave the car now and find your own way home. Go on, open the door and get out.
I sat still, my hands in my lap, not knowing whether he meant it or not.
Well, he said, what are you going to do about it?
Had I been a year or two younger, I think I should have cried. Children's tears are very near the surface and come at the first crisis. As it was, I felt them prick behind my eyes, felt the ready colour flood my face, and catching a sudden glimpse of myself in the glass above the windscreen, saw in full the sorry spectacle that I made, with troubled eyes and scarlet cheeks, lank hair flopping under broad felt hat. I want to go home, I said, my voice perilously near to trembling, and without a word he started up the engine, let in the clutch, and turned the car round the way that we had come. Swiftly we covered the ground, far too swiftly, I thought, far too easily, and the callous countryside watched us with indifference. We came to the bend in the road that I had wished to imprison as a memory, and the peasant girl was gone, and the colour was flat, and it was no more, after all, than any bend in any road, passed by 100 motorists. The glamour of it had gone with my happy mood, and at the thought of it, my frozen face quivered into feeling. My adult pride was lost, and those despicable tears rejoicing at their conquest welled into my eyes and strayed upon my cheeks. I could not check them, for they came unbidden, and had I reached in my pocket for a handkerchief, he would have seen. I must let them fall untouched and suffer the bitter salt upon my lips, plumbing the depths of humiliation. Whether he had turned his head to look at me, I do not know, for I watched the road ahead with blurred and steady stare. But suddenly he put out his hand and took hold of mine and kissed it, still saying nothing, and then he threw his handkerchief on my lap, which I was too ashamed to touch. I thought of all those heroines of fiction who looked pretty when they cried, and what a contrast I must make with blotched and swollen face and red rims to my eyes. It was a dismal finish to my morning, and the day that stretched ahead of me was long. I had to lunch with Mrs. Van Hopper in her room because the nurse was going out, and afterwards she would make me play bazique with all the tireless energy of the convalescent. I knew I should stifle in that room. There was something sordid about the tumbled sheets, the sprawling blankets and the thumped pillows, and that bedside table dusty with powder, spilt scent and melting liquid rouge. Her bed would be littered with the separated sheets of the daily papers, folded anyhow, while French novels with curling edges and the covers torn kept company with American magazines. The mash stubs of cigarettes lay everywhere, in cleansing cream, in a dish of grapes, and on the floor beneath the bed. Visitors were lavish with their flowers, and the vases stood cheek by jowl in any fashion, hothouse exotics crammed beside mimosa, while a great beribboned casket crowned them all, with tier upon tier of crystallized fruit. Later her friends would come in for a drink, which I must mix for them, hating my task, shy and ill at ease in my corner, hemmed in by their parrot chatter, and I would be a whipping boy again, blushing for her, when, excited by her little crowd, she must sit up in bed and talk too loudly, laugh too long, reach to the portable gramophone and start a record, shrugging her large shoulders to the tune. I preferred her irritable and snappy, her hair done up in pins, scolding me for forgetting her taxol. All this awaited me in the suite. While he, once he had left me at the hotel, would go away somewhere alone, towards the sea perhaps, feel the wind on his cheek, follow the sun, and it might happen that he would lose himself in those memories that I knew nothing of, that I could not share. He would wander down the years that were gone. The gulf that lay between us was wider now than it had ever been, and he stood away from me with his back turned on the further shore. I felt young and small and very much alone, and now, in spite of my pride, I found his handkerchief and blew my nose, throwing my drab appearance to the winds. It could never matter. "The hell with this," he said suddenly, as though angry, as though bored, and he pulled me beside him and put his arm round my shoulder, still looking straight ahead of him, his right hand on the wheel. He drove, I remember, even faster than before. "I suppose you're young enough to be my daughter, and I don't know how to deal with you," he said. The road narrowed then to a corner, and he had to swerve to avoid a dog. I thought he would release me, but he went on holding me beside him, and when the corner was passed and the road came straight again, he did not let me go. "You can forget all I said to you this morning," he said. "That's all finished and done with. Don't let's ever think of it again. My family always call me Maxim. I'd like you to do the same. You've been formal with me long enough." He felt for the brim of my hat and took hold of it, throwing it over his shoulder to the back seat, and then bent down and kissed the top of my head. "Promise me you will never wear black satin," he said. I smiled then, and he laughed back at me. And the morning was gay again. The morning was a shining thing. Mrs. Van Hopper and the afternoon did not matter a flip of the finger. It would pass so quickly, and there would be tonight, and another day tomorrow. I was cocksure, jubilant. At that moment, I almost had the courage to claim equality. I saw myself strolling into Mrs. Van Hopper's bedroom rather late for my bezique, and when questioned by her, yawning carelessly, saying, "I forgot the time, I've been lunching with Maxim." I was still child enough to consider a Christian name like a plume in the hat, though from the very first he had called me by mine. The morning, for all its shadowed moments, had promoted me to a new level of friendship. I did not lag so far behind as I thought. He had kissed me, too, a natural business, comforting and quiet. Not dramatic as in books, not embarrassing. It seemed to bring about an ease in our relationship. It made everything more simple. The gulf between us had been bridged after all. I was to call him Maxim, and that afternoon playing bezique with Mrs. Van Hopper was not so tedious as it might have been, though my courage failed me and I said nothing of my morning. For when, gathering her cards together at the end and reaching for the box, she said casually, "Tell me, is Max de Winter still in the hotel?" I hesitated a moment, like a diver on the brink, then lost my nerve and my tutored self-possession, saying, "Yes, I believe so. He comes into the restaurant for his meals." Someone has told her, I thought. Someone has seen us together. The tennis professional has complained. The manager has sent a note. And I waited for her attack. But she went on putting the cards back into the box, yawning a little while I straightened the tumbled bed. I gave her the bowl of powder, the rouge compact, and the lipstick, and she put away the cards and took up the hand glass from the table by her side. "Attractive creature," she said, "but queer-tempered, I should think, difficult to know. I thought he might have made some gesture of asking one to Manderley that day in the lounge, but he was very close." I said nothing. I watched her pick up the lipstick and outline a bow upon her hard mouth. "I never saw her," she said, holding the glass away to see the effect. "But I believe she was very lovely, exquisitely turned out and brilliant in every way. They used to give tremendous parties at Manderley. It was all very sudden and tragic, and I believe he adored her. I need the darker shade of powder with this brilliant red, my dear. Fetch it, will you, and put this box back in the drawer." And we were busy then with powder, scent, and rouge, until the bell rang and her visitors came in. I handed them their drinks, dully, saying little. I changed the records on the gramophone. I threw away the stubs of cigarettes.
Been doing any sketching lately, little lady?
The forced heartiness of an old banker, his monocle dangling on a string and my bright smile of insincerity.
No, not very lately. Will you have another cigarette?
It was not I that answered. I was not there at all. I was following a phantom in my mind, whose shadowy form had taken shape at last. Her features were blurred, her colouring indistinct. The setting of her eyes and the texture of her hair was still uncertain, still to be revealed. She had beauty that endured, and a smile that was not forgotten. Somewhere her voice still lingered, and the memory of her words. There were places she had visited, and things that she had touched. Perhaps in cupboards there were clothes that she had worn, with the scent about them still. In my bedroom, under my pillow, I had a book that she had taken in her hands, and I could see her turning to that first white page, smiling as she wrote, and shaking the bent nib. Max, from Rebecca. It must have been his birthday, and she had put it amongst her other presents on the breakfast table, and they had laughed together as he tore off the paper and string. She leant, perhaps, over his shoulder while he read. Max. She called him Max. It was familiar, gay, and easy on the tongue. The family could call him Maxim if they liked, grandmothers and aunts, and people like myself, quiet and dull and youthful, who did not matter. Max was her choice. The word was her possession. She had written it with so great a confidence on the flyleaf of that book, that bold, slanting hand stabbing the white paper, the symbol of herself so certain, so assured. How many times she must have written to him thus, in how many varied moods. Little notes scrawled on half sheets of paper, and letters when he was away, page after page, intimate, their news. Her voice echoing through the house and down the garden, careless and familiar like the writing in the book. And I had to call him Maxim.
Chapter 6. Packing up. The nagging worry of departure. Lost keys, unwritten labels, tissue paper lying on the floor. I hate it all. Even now, when I've done so much of it. When I live, as the saying goes, in my boxes. Even today, when shutting drawers and flinging wide an hotel wardrobe, or the impersonal shelves of a furnished villa, is a methodical matter of routine, I am aware of sadness, of a sense of loss. Here, I say, we have lived, we have been happy. This has been ours, however brief the time. Though two nights only have been spent beneath a roof, yet we leave something of ourselves behind. Nothing material, not a hairpin on a dressing table, not an empty bottle of aspirin tablets, not a handkerchief beneath a pillow, but something indefinable, a moment of our lives, a thought, a mood. This house sheltered us. We spoke. We loved within those walls. That was yesterday. Today we pass on. We see it no more. And we are different. Changed in some infinitesimal way. We can never be quite the same again. Even stopping for luncheon at a wayside inn and going to a dark, unfamiliar room to wash my hands, the handle of the door unknown to me, the wallpaper peeling in strips, a funny little cracked mirror above the basin. For this moment, it is mine. It belongs to me. We know one another. This is the present. There is no past and no future. Here I am washing my hands, and the cracked mirror shows me to myself, suspended, as it were, in time. This is me. This moment will not pass. And then I open the door and go to the dining room, where he is sitting waiting for me at a table. And I think how in that moment I have aged, passed on, how I have advanced one step towards an unknown destiny. We smile, we choose our lunch, we speak of this and that. But, I say to myself, I am not she who left him 5 minutes ago. She stayed behind. I am another woman, older, more mature,
I saw in the paper the other day that the Hotel Côte d'Azur at Monte Carlo had gone to new management and had a different name. The rooms have been redecorated and the whole interior changed.
Perhaps Mrs. Van Hopper's suite on the first floor exists no more. Perhaps there is no trace of the small bedroom that was mine. I knew I should never go back. That day I knelt on the floor and fumbled with the awkward catch of her trunk. The episode was finished with the snapping of the lock. I glanced out of the window, and it was like turning the page of a photograph album. Those rooftops and that sea were mine no more. They belonged to yesterday, to the past. The rooms already wore an empty air, stripped of our possessions, and there was something hungry about the suite, as though it wished us gone, and the new arrivals who would come tomorrow in our place. The heavy luggage stood ready strapped and locked in the corridor outside. The smaller stuff would be finished later. Waste paper baskets groaned under litter. All her half-empty medicine bottles and discarded face cream jars, with torn-up bills and letters, drawers in tables gaped. The bureau was stripped bare. She had flung a letter at me the morning before, as I poured out her coffee at breakfast. "Helen is sailing for New York on Saturday. Little Nancy has a threatened appendix, and they've cabled her to go home. That's decided me. We're going, too. I'm tired to death of Europe, and we can come back in the early fall. How'd you like the idea of seeing New York?"
The thought was worse than prison. Something of my misery must have shown in my face, for at first she looked astonished, then annoyed.
"What an odd, unsatisfactory child you are. I can't make you out. Don't you realize that at home, girls in your position without any money can have the grandest fun, plenty of boys and excitement, all in your own class? You can have your own little set of friends and needn't be at my beck and call as much as you are here. I thought you didn't care for Monte."
"I've got used to it," I said lamely, wretchedly, my mind a conflict.
"Well, you'll just have to get used to New York, that's all. We're going to catch that boat of Helen's, and it means seeing about our passage at once. Go down to the reception office right away and make that young clerk show some sign of efficiency. Your day will be so full that you won't have time to have any pangs about leaving Monte."
She laughed disagreeably, squashing her cigarette in the butter, and went to the telephone to ring up all her friends. I could not face the office right away. I went into the bathroom and locked the door, and sat down on the cork mat, my head in my hands. It had happened at last, the business of going away. It was all over. Tomorrow evening I should be in the train, holding her jewel case and her rug, like a maid, and she in that monstrous new hat with the single quill, dwarfed in her fur coat, sitting opposite me in the wagon-lit. We would wash and clean our teeth in that stuffy little compartment with the rattling doors, the splashed basin, the damp towel, the soap with a single hair on it, the carafe half-filled with water, the inevitable notice on the wall, "Sous le lavabo se trouve une vase," while every rattle, every throb and jerk of the screaming train would tell me that the miles carried me away from him, sitting alone in the restaurant of the hotel, at the table I had known, reading a book, not minding, not thinking. I should say goodbye to him in the lounge, perhaps, before we left. A furtive scrambled farewell because of her. And there would be a pause, and a smile, and words like, "Yes, of course, do write, and I've never thanked you properly for being so kind, and you must forward those snapshots. What about your address? Well, I'll have to let you know." And he would light a cigarette casually, asking a passing waiter for a light, while I thought, 4½ more minutes to go. I shall never see him again. Because I was going, because it was over, there would be suddenly nothing more to say. We would be strangers, meeting for the last and only time, while my mind clamoured painfully, crying, "I love you so much. I'm terribly unhappy. This has never come to me before, and never will again." My face would be set in a prim, conventional smile. My voice would be saying, "Look at that funny old man over there. I wonder who he is. He must be new here." And we would waste the last moments laughing at a stranger, because we were already strangers to one another. "I hope the snapshots come out well," repeating oneself in desperation. "And he, yes, that one of the square ought to be good. The light was just right." Having both of us gone into all that at the time, having agreed upon it, and anyway, I would not care if the result was fogged and black, because this was the last moment. The final goodbye had been attained. Well, my dreadful smile stretching across my face, thanks most awfully once again. It's been so ripping, using words I had never used before. Ripping! What did it mean? God knows. I did not care. It was the sort of word that schoolgirls had for hockey, wildly inappropriate to those past weeks of misery and exultation. Then the doors of the lift would open upon Mrs. Van Hopper, and I would cross the lounge to meet her, and he would stroll back again to his corner and pick up a paper. Sitting there, ridiculously, on the court mat of the bathroom floor, I lived it all. And our journey, too, and our arrival in New York. The shrill voice of Helen, a narrower edition of her mother, and Nancy, her horrid little child. The college boys that Mrs. Van Hopper would have me know, and the young bank clerks, suitable to my station. "Let's make Wednesday night a date. Do you like hot music?" Snub-nosed boys with shiny faces, having to be polite and wanting to be alone with my own thoughts, as I was now, locked behind the bathroom door. She came and rattled on the door. "What are you doing?" "All right. I'm sorry. I'm coming now." And I made a pretense of turning on the tap, of bustling about and folding a towel on a rail. She glanced at me curiously as I opened the door. "What a time you've been! Can't afford to dream this morning, you know. There's too much to be done." He would go back to Manderley, of course, in a few weeks. I felt certain of that. There would be a great pile of letters waiting for him in the hall, and mine amongst them, scribbled on the boat. A forced letter, trying to amuse, describing my fellow passengers. It would lie about inside his blotter, and he would answer it weeks later, one Sunday morning in a hurry before lunch, having come across it when he paid some bills. And then... no more. Nothing until the final degradation of the Christmas card. Manderley itself, perhaps, against a frosted background. The message printed saying, "A happy Christmas and a prosperous new year from Maximilian de Winter." Gold lettering. But to be kind, he would have run his pen through the printed name and written in ink underneath, "From Maxim," as a sort of sop. And if there was space, a message, "I hope you're enjoying New York." A lick of the envelope, a stamp, and tossed in a pile of 100 others.
"It's too bad you are leaving tomorrow," said the reception clerk, telephone in hand. "The ballet starts next week, you know. Does Mrs. Van Hopper know?"
I dragged myself back from Christmas at Manderley to the realities of the Wagon Lee. Mrs. Van Hopper lunched in the restaurant for the first time since her influenza, and I had a pain in the pit of my stomach as I followed her into the room. He had gone to Cannes for the day, that much I knew, for he had warned me the day before, but I kept thinking the waiter might commit an indiscretion and say, "Will Mademoiselle be dining with Monsieur tonight, as usual?" I felt a little sick whenever he came near the table, but he said nothing. The day was spent in packing, and in the evening people came to say goodbye. We dined in the sitting room, and she went to bed directly afterwards. Still, I had not seen him. I went down to the lounge about 9:30 on the pretext of getting luggage labels, and he was not there. The odious reception clerk smiled when he saw me. "If you are looking for Mr. de Winter, we had a message from Cannes to say he would not be back before midnight." I want a packet of luggage labels," I said, but I saw by his eye that he was not deceived. So there would be no last evening after all. The hour I had looked forward to all day must be spent by myself alone, in my own bedroom, gazing at my revelation suitcase and the stout hold-all. Perhaps it was just as well, for I should have made a poor companion, and he must have read my face. I know I cried that night, bitter, youthful tears that could not come from me today. That kind of crying deep into a pillow does not happen after we are 21. The throbbing head, the swollen eyes, the tight, contracted throat, and the wild anxiety in the morning to hide all traces from the world, sponging with cold water, dabbing eau de cologne, the furtive dash of powder that is significant in itself. The panic, too, that one might cry again, the tears swelling without control, and a fatal trembling of the mouth lead one to disaster. I remember opening wide my window and leaning out, hoping the fresh morning air would blow away the telltale pink under the powder, and the sun had never seemed so bright, nor the days so full of promise. Monte Carlo was suddenly full of kindliness and charm, the one place in the world that held sincerity. I loved it. Affection overwhelmed me. I wanted to live there all my life, and I was leaving it today. This is the last time I brush my hair before the looking-glass, the last time I shall clean my teeth into the basin. Never again sleep in that bed, never more turn off the switch of that electric light. There I was, padding about in a dressing-gown, making a slough of sentiment out of a commonplace.